As you know, the subject of this seminar is problems of meditation. But the word meditation in English is usually associated with thinking things over. And what I'm talking about is not that at all. But we use the word to translate Indian words such as dhyana, which in Chinese is chan and in Japanese zen. And we use it to translate words like yoga and sadhana, which means more or less a spiritual discipline. But the function of what we call meditation in the East is a process for changing consciousness, changing the quality of consciousness, changing the way in which you experience your own existence. And as you know, all over the world, with some exceptions among quite primitive people, we experience our existence in a rather odd way. That is to say, as being isolated individuals, highly disconnected from the external world. We feel that we are almost strangers in the earth, even though we are just a symptomatic of the earth, as a tree, or a cloud, or the oceans, or a mountain. Only we move around rather more freely, and our behavior is extremely complicated. Also, we are more responsive to the movements of nature than, say, a mountain is. If you hit a bell, it will just say dong. But if you hit a human being, something much more complicated will happen. But it's quite clear that this way in which we experience our existence is a hallucination. It just doesn't fit the facts. It doesn't fit the facts of science. Because when scientists describe the behavior of human beings, or the behavior of any other living organism whatsoever, they find they can't do so unless they describe the behavior of the environment at the same time, that is to say, of the external world. And this forces one to the conclusion that what you are describing is not simply the behavior of an individual, but the behavior of what we would call a physical field. And so, in this sense, then, the individual and the field, the environment, are the same process. Only it's a highly complex process. And the difficulty we have in seeing it as a unity is simply that we suffer from a kind of myopia. You see, if you take, let's put it in a sort of an abstract way. There are a whole series of bodies, points, and they may be planets, they might be cells in tissue, or they might be a flock of birds. And as you watch them, you see that they're all moving in the same way. Supposing you saw a vast chessboard with innumerable squares covered with knights, and all the knights were moving through the knight's move, but in exactly the same pattern, you would then identify this whole performance as a thing. You would say it is one thing. It is a bevy of knights, or a flock of birds, or a ganglion of cells. Now, the performance of this collective might become a little bit more complicated as one sees a difference between a surface with an even pattern, with a uniform pattern, and a surface with a complex pattern on it. Although with a surface with a complex pattern, you might call a picture. And a picture is a thing. So let us suppose that on our vast chessboard, the knights still kept the essential pattern of a knight's move. But certain groups of them did it towards the far side of the board, and others did it towards the near side, some did it towards the left, and some did it towards the right. Then you would see a much more complicated process happening. But you would still call it a process. Well, let's make it a little more complicated, you see? And soon you will see the whole movement of the knights will assume before your eyes what I would call a wiggly performance. It will look like a, let's say, a bucket of worms, where they're all wiggling in different directions. And the only reason you don't call it a thing anymore is it's too complicated to figure out what is the pattern of the whole thing. There are, as we say, in it, too many variables. But it still essentially is the same sort of thing it was in the beginning, except that it's just become more complicated. And so, if you want to keep track of it, the only thing to do, and that really isn't keeping track of it, but it's sort of keeping some sort of hold on it, is to focus your attention on one of them. And you follow the path of one worm in the bucket, you see. And you watch that going around, and watch it going around, and you see, you know, you get rather fond of it. You begin to take sides with it. And before you know where you are, you've identified yourself with that particular worm. You're on its side. And if other worms should clobber it, you say, hey, don't do that, because it loses my thread, you see, my worm. I wanted to keep track of all this. And if you clobber my worm, I'm at a loss. I have to pick up another. And you see, every individual is exactly in that situation. We have identified ourselves with a particular organism. And we're interested in it. We've been very carefully brought up to take that point of view, to take one's own side. And it's taken many, many millennia to produce that point of view in us. And therefore, it isn't going to be easy to take another point of view altogether. We are myopically, in other words, fixated on our what we call our own body. And a little while ago, I don't know if I've told you this story before, but I was asked by the Weapons Research Laboratory of the U.S. Air Force to go there and consult with them about moral behavior, of all things. they got a panel of four philosophers, or there was at least one theologian, and they wanted to know what was our basis for moral conduct. Well, I said, when it came my turn to tell them, you gentlemen here, of course, are all very realistic, hard-boiled people, and I'm not going to mess around with you and give you a lot of mawkish sentimentality. I tell you frankly, my basis for moral behavior is total self-interest. Of course, I'm not crude about it. I just don't go around and bang people on the head and tell them to give me what I want. I do it much more subtly. I'm ingratiating. I tell them, I give the impression that I'm really very fond of them and going to be sociable and well-behaved. And so by this setting honey to catch flies, I'll get what I want. And naturally, we must observe this basis for moral behavior, not only on a personal level, but also on a national level. And it's your job to conduct the strategy of the United States by such subtle methods as we get what we want. Only, of course, you are the rather hard-hitting fellows, and it's up more to the Secretary of State to put on the cunning. Now, I said, the problem about this is it raises two further questions. The first question it raises is, what do I want? And the second question is, who am I? And this becomes extraordinarily interesting and quite complicated when you really begin to think it through. And it is your job as high strategist to think these things through and not just take short-sighted goals. Because if you do, you can get into tremendous trouble. I mean, what will you do with Vietnam when you get it? Any conqueror has a terrible time looking after his victory. Because it's just more responsibility. And is that what you want? You want all that responsibility? Do you want to be God? Do you want to rule the world? Well, of course, nobody does. We don't, in the first place, want to rule our own bodies, let alone the world, and so we've got a marvelous contraption going inside us, whereby most of the things that go on inside our bodies don't even have to be thought about. And so it goes very well. The only time we have to think about anything is when it goes wrong. We have this homeostatic process going on inside us, which takes care of temperature and all that sort of stuff, digests our food for us without having to think about that. And that's just great. And another word for that system is democracy. Because all we've delegated the authority for regulating our bodies to all the organs and cells and so on. And they manage pretty well. Another name for it is anarchy. Not in the sense of chaos, but in the sense of anarchy, as it was taught by Prince Kropotkin, philosophical anarchy, which is, he would say, for example, that if you have a bunch of pebbles in a box and you shake it, they will eventually arrange themselves in an order. And so in the same way, he said, you can only get human beings to behave themselves properly by trusting them, by letting them, by say, in a big business, you have to delegate authority or you go quite mad. A person who tries to govern a large corporation or a political unit of some kind must delegate authority, because if he doesn't, he'll have to think of everything that's going on all the time, and he'll never even get a moment to sleep, because he's the perpetual policeman or the big brother. And there he'll be sitting in his super office with hundreds of television screens peeking at what people are doing. Of course, he'll probably have some subordinate peekers, but he's got to peek on the peekers and see that they do their jobs. And he just, in other words, he's tied up. He's completely in a trap. So we got into this kind of thing, and what do you want? And they began to have their minds expanded, because nobody really knows what he wants. It's perfectly fantastic to talk, as I have for many years, with young people when I've been in college situations. And the thing that one talks about most in the long run is what is generally called vocational guidance. What do you want to do? Well, some people say they just want to paint or write poetry. And others say they'd like to ride horses. Others say they want to make money. And they laugh at the people who want to paint and ride horses, because they say, you never make any money that way. But I always said in this kind of counseling, do what you really want to do, and to hell with the money. Because you will find out that if you think that what you want is money, that's not what you want at all. Unless you are merely fascinated in the mathematics of making money, which of course has a certain interest to it, because it's like playing poker. But if you think you want money and that will make you happy, it won't do anything of the kind, because all the extraordinarily rich people I know are for the most part miserable. They have no idea how to enjoy themselves. They are either so absorbed in making and keeping the money and defending it against other people and against the government that they worry about it day and night, or if they don't worry about it, they worry instead about their health or their family relationships. There's always something to worry about. It doesn't matter how secure you are, how well off you are, there's always something to keep you awake at night if you're the worrying type. And the people who think that what they want is money, they say, well, I'd like to be rich. Well, I would say, be specific. What sort of wealth do you want? You can't drive 6 cars at once. You can't live in 10 homes at once, nor eat 12 roast beefs at one meal. So in concrete terms, please. Please make it as concrete as possible. Should I say as material as possible? What do you want? And who do you want to marry? And be specific. Don't just say, I want a beautiful and intelligent woman. Because there is no such thing in the abstract. There is only this particular beautiful and intelligent woman, or that one. So you have to get very specific in thinking this question through. And soon you discover, and let's just take the question of marriage as an example. This may seem to be a little bit off the subject, but it really leads directly into it. Let's take the question of marriage. Now, you say, yes, I want this, I want that, I want the other. All right, let's go along now. Would you like a woman who always does exactly what you want her to do, that she fulfills your wishes even before you've expressed them, that she is completely responsive to you. You think that over for a while, and some people would jump at it and say, yes, that's exactly what I want. But I say, to think about it just a little bit more, will you? And they go on thinking a while, and they suddenly realize that what they would have would be a plastic doll. Very highly mechanized one, but very, very complicated one. But that's what it would be. Because she would never be able to surprise you. And so when you, it would be like a plastic doll, because when you push a plastic doll, it yields. And then when you take your finger away, it goes back to its ordinary position. Well, then you push that and it behaves that way. You say, that's not alive. That's just a doll. But what you like about a real live woman is that if you push her a little bit, you don't know what she's going to do next. And so she comes back at you, and you realize that she is a center of life, just like you are. See? Or she's another one. And that's interesting. Now, this moral is, in other words, applicable to everything. If you want to control everything, all you will have will be a doll. But we want it to bounce back in an unpredictable way. But not too unpredictable. But the something else we want, you see. We want a relationship with a real living being. And that means you've got to let things get out of control so that you can be surprised. Now notice, and we're going to come back to this, notice. That's the state of affairs we're in, however much we may complain about it. We are in this state of affairs where we're always being surprised and where things are only very vaguely predictable. We can push technology and we can push science, maybe in the coming centuries, to extraordinary degrees where we can predict all kinds of things. But I'm quite sure that as we approach that goal, there will be an increasing anti-scientific revolution. We can see it already among the hippies, that there is a tendency to want to abandon very, very high technology. Because it is, as they say, and this is a sort of symbolic expression, covering the earth with concrete. Taking away the thing that we call, and we really don't know what we mean, we call it nature. It's somehow against nature. And when we say nature, we mean the smell of the earth, we mean the wind in the trees, we mean vegetation, grass, clouds, water, all sorts of funky things. And there's something in us, you see, that yearns for that always. And yet we have a battle inside ourselves. When it gets too funky, we say it stinks and we want to clean it up. And we're always trying to straighten things out. Nature is all wiggly all over the place. But whenever you see anything straight, like a house or a highway, or factories, you know, people have been around because they always make things straight. They're bothered by wiggly things, even though we're all very wiggly. So we're always straightening it out. And so, yet at the same time, when we get it too straight, we don't like it. But what do we want? Well, you can always say we want something betwixt and between. We want a certain amount of control, yes. But we also want a certain amount of randomness. We like things to be tidy. We like things to be simple. We like things to be comprehensible, and yet we don't really. And what we want is a kind of orderly randomness and a random orderliness. That's what Buddha called the middle way. And but the maintenance of the middle way is very difficult. It's like walking a tightrope. And when you walk a tightrope, you're always swaying a little bit from side to side. You're counterbalancing yourself. And so to keep the middle way is a matter of constant counterbalancing, and that's difficult. And so we say, well, I know I did want the middle way, but it's awfully difficult to keep it. And that's rather a bore, too. So we really don't know what we want. And yet, in a way, we want what we've got. Because profoundly, looking at it from the most profound point of view, we wouldn't have what we've got if we didn't want it. That's what the Buddhists and the Hindus call karma. The doctrine that what comes to you is a return to you of what goes out of you. Karma, when you say, it is your karma that this has happened, it means very strictly, it is your doing that it has happened. Because the word karma means doing or action. But of course, because we are constantly complaining and say, I didn't want this and I didn't want that, and somebody else is to blame, and you did it, or the universe did it, or something like that, or God did it, we are constantly unaware of the fact that we get what we want. And we are unaware of what we want also because we want a lot of things that we don't admit we want. And we don't admit it to ourselves. You know that time and time again where somebody wishes their mother was dead but can't possibly admit that. And finally they go to psychoanalysis and it comes out they really do wish their mother were out of the way. And, you know, that's a great revelation. So in the same way you will find we have all kinds of concealed wishes that we won't admit. And if we really went into it, I think we would find that we are, on the whole, living the way we want to live. That would be embarrassing to find out for very many reasons, not only because we would discover all sorts of villainy within ourselves, but also because we would discover a great deal of power within ourselves. And that's dangerous because you might begin to think you were God. And this then raises the second problem, the moment you really get into it, when you ask, what do you want? It raises the second problem, who are you? What are you? And we haven't thought that over by a long shot. Because let's just consider a very simple problem in perception. You cannot identify visually a figure without a background. You cannot identify a sound unless it can be heard against relative silence or in combination with a limited range of other sounds, again against silence, as in listening, say, to four-part music. Now, if you can't have the sound without the silence, if you can't have the figure without the background, doesn't it occur to you, if you think about it, that the sound and the silence are all part of the same process? One of the most curious problems of human consciousness is what I will call ignorance or ignorance of space, of background, of the field in which any given event happens or in which any so-called thing exists. Space is ordinarily understood to be nothing. So we ignore space. There are all kinds of space. We can talk about intergalactic space, interstellar space, space between people, space in a room, space to stretch in, and only physicists and architects and painters really begin to be aware of space as something that's there. And so when astronomers talk about curved space or properties of space, the average person says they're talking total nonsense. You can't have curved nothing. You can't have properties of pure emptiness. And so they feel just the same way as people used to feel long ago when it suggested that the Earth was spherical. Well, they said you can't have a spherical Earth because the people on the opposite side would fall off. Because they thought of gravity as one-directional through space. They couldn't see it as a force that was centripetal. So when we say, for example, we should go on to higher things, well, who's higher? Because every one of us being, as it were, having our feet pointing to the center of the Earth, must have our heads, which are up, pointing to regions of space which are vastly differentiated. So which way is up? Your up or my up? And people have a great difficulty, you see, in getting new ideas of this kind. And this is the difference that is so often brought up by people who discuss Oriental philosophy or mysticism. They say, I understand what you say in theory, but I don't actually feel it. I don't realize it. So in the same way somebody hundreds of years ago might have said to a geographer, yes, I understand your theory of the Earth being spherical, but I don't feel it. I feel I'm living on a flat thing. I suppose a lot of people living today feel they're living on a flat thing. But if you've done a great deal of travel by air, and certainly if you've been in orbit as an astronaut, you jolly well know it isn't flat. You've realized it. So, in a similar way, I think that in the course of history, we have realized colors. There's evidence to show that only quite recently have people really been able to differentiate blue from green. In Chinese, there is one word meaning blue and green, and it means the color of nature. In Homer, there is a reference to the wine-dark sea. And we wonder whether those early Greeks were aware of the differentiation of blue from the dark red of wine. See, the dark red of wine is beginning to approach purple. You see that the spectrum, we always look at in books when we study physics and in certain physical experiments, we see the spectrum as a band, as when we look at at the rainbow, we look at a section of the rainbow. And we see a band with red at one side and purple at the other. What we don't realize is that the spectrum should be drawn as a circle in which the different colors radiate from the center. And we would see that when you've gone through red, orange, yellow, etc., around to purple, you go again to red. Because after all, what is purple except the mixture of red with blue? So, everything goes round like that. Everything in the world, as a matter of fact, is a crisscrossing or interlocking of many dimensions of spectra. You take the spectrum of sound. If anybody thought to do it, they could make up a spectrum of smells. You can make a spectrum of emotions. You can make a spectrum of tactile vibrations. You could make a spectrum of textures. And when you put all these things together, as you say, it is blue and hard, or that's where you've crossed two spectra. We don't usually think of something that is blue and noisy, it would really be quite easy to conceive something that was. We don't ordinarily hear colors, but you can. You can take LSD and hear colors and or see the color of sounds and realize that your senses are fundamentally one sense, differentiated. It's very tender and sensitive in the eyes because it can, by being so sensitive, respond to the extremely subtle vibrations of light. With the ears, it's a little less tender, but the ears respond to the subtle vibrations of sound, vibrations in the air. And then the nerves on the epidermis, they are a little cruder, but they respond to the vibrations of so-called hard objects, or to vibrations on the same spectrum as light, but we call it heat. And then when you begin to think about these spectra, just begin to feel about them, you find there are some places in this interlocking mesh of spectra that you'd rather be than others. You don't want to be where it's too hot. You don't want to be where the light's too bright, or where there isn't any light. You don't want to be on the spectrum of touch, where the sense of touch is excruciating, sharp. You're always trying to move away from that. But you see, there are so many spectra interlocking with each other that when you move away from one point that you don't like, you're very liable to bump into another that you don't like on a different level. And so eventually you realize that just as you can't have the red end without the purple, you can't have the pleasure end of the tactile sensation without there being also the pain end. Because if you weren't responsive to the pain end, you couldn't respond to the pleasure end. You must have the whole spectrum to have any of it. And the longer you go into that, the more you think it over, the more you realize that you say something that mystics often say, but which ordinary people just can't understand, when they say that everything is harmonious. It's absolutely absurd, but everything is really harmonious in the end. And all of it is somehow just as it should be. And the ordinary person says, well, that's absurd. Let's take the problem, say, that we're all faced with, the atomic age. There's a real possibility we can blow up the planet. And we might do just that. Because I'm involved in the situation. If I were going to bet on it, and there was somewhere to place my bet, which there isn't, I would bet that human beings will blow up the planet. Taking a hard, realistic point of view, because I think human beings are going to do the most stupid things they can do. Like I've never, any time I voted in an election, my candidate never won. So I tend not to vote. But I realize at the same time I'm involved in this scene. I can't get out of it. There's nowhere to place my bet. Therefore, I have to do something to make things come out the way I think I want them to come out. But let's suppose they do blow up the planet. Well, this is just a fantasy, but supposing they turn it into a star. Maybe that's the way all stars started. Maybe there's a sort of a process which works like this, that here's the star, and it, as it blows up, it scatters all sorts of fragments out, and these become planets. And then every so often, some star has a planet that starts generating life. And life gets more and more intelligent. And it starts working around and fiddling, and then it starts asking questions. What is all this? You know, what is matter? And they investigate it, and they prod it, and they electrify it, and do this, that, and the other, and finally, bam, the whole thing goes off again. So that you could say in this way, in the evolution of the universe, all stars mean that there were once people around, and so on. You see, then you could construct a vision of things where it was all perfectly all right, that you have to have bad people as well as good people, just as you have to have the slugs in the garden and weeds and all sorts of things you don't approve of in order to have something that you can approve of. You see, this is what the mystic feels. He suddenly gets it, you see, that it's all okay. And, of course, the average person thinks that's a very dangerous thought. There are several reasons for thinking it's a very dangerous thought. One is that it seems to give justification for any kind of behavior, and therefore to overrule all the ordinary reasons for being moral and cooperative, although it neglects the fact that you might then discover quite other reasons for being moral. I mean, you might be so happy as a result of finding this out that your happiness would become infectious. After all, if I'm suddenly going to be given $1 million, I'm not going to suddenly run out of doors and shoot everybody. I'm much more liable, as a gregarious sort of fellow, to invite people in for a party. Also, people would say, if somebody realized that, well, that's subversive, that's awful, because that's bringing democracy into the kingdom of heaven. which is a point which I won't go into right now, but it's enormously interesting what that implies. Or other people would say, it's just the opposite of bringing democracy into the kingdom of heaven. It's that you feel you're God, and that from your point of view, everything's all right. God's in his heavens, all's right with the world. Or else they say, well, it's sentimental. A lot of people say this. I've run into this type particularly in the academic world. They say the truth of life is, fundamentally, if you're a realist, and if you're really sensitive and aware, life is tragedy. And that this ennobles it. They feel that if they face the fact that the world is basically tragic, that human existence in particular is tragic, because it's full of hope and love and joy and so on, but it's doomed to come to a bad end. That's tragic. But to face tragedy and so on is to be very noble. Well, I sort of disagree with this. I say you're just strutting on the stage saying how noble you are, because that's the only resort you've got. And wouldn't you really enjoy your life much more if you could see that there was behind it all a possibility that it wasn't tragic and that it was a tremendous celebration? Only that on the way to realizing that it is, there are all kinds of things that go bang, and those nasty shocks and horrible surprises and difficult problems, because you would be bored if there weren't. You have to wiggle yourself through all these mazes, because that's what there is. That's the way we do it. Otherwise, we get bored. But, you know, when the wiggling through the mazes and the shocks and the bangs and everything get too much, some people say, well, isn't it time to wake up? Isn't it time to stop this myopia of imagining that there is a right place in the spectrum where you can be comfortable? And I'm talking about the multidimensional spectrum of all the different levels on which we live. Can't we see that the whole thing is necessary? And that, as a matter of fact, you are the whole thing. Only the whole thing has a very fascinating capacity, which is to be able to concentrate its attention in various places. And we call these places people. And therefore, to surprise itself with another person, you see? In the Upanishads, there's one Upanishad which says that in the beginning was the self. And it said, I am. And thus it is that when anyone is asked who is there, he says, it is I. And after that gives whatever particular name he may have. And when it realized that it was alone, the self was afraid. But then it said, of what should I be afraid? For I am all that there is, and fear can come only from another. Keep that in mind. Then it said, but I am alone. And it experienced no delight, as one who is alone has no delight. And therefore, it split itself. And one half was male, and the other half female. See, you can't have delight without, now you've got another. You've got the possibility of fear. And so, the he part copulated with the she part and produced all human beings. But she said, how can he have intercourse with me since he is originally me? This is incest. And so she turned herself into a cow He immediately turned himself into a bull, and from their copulation were produced all cattle. But then she turned herself into a mare, but he immediately into a stallion, and so they made all horses. Then she turned herself into a ewe, and he became a ram, and so came all sheep. And then all the various beasts, down to the very ants, and so the world was created. This is a sort of an interesting backwards creation story in which the human beings come first and then all the other creatures. But in a mythological way of talking, that's the kind of game we're involved in. And so the process of meditation has as its objective to enable us to have the vision of the mystic, to have what is called, I think, perhaps unfortunately, cosmic consciousness. Trouble with the word cosmic is that it's so associated with daft old ladies who wear violet and read Madame Blavatsky or something. and always going around telling people that something's very cosmic. I remember I had a friend who became like that. She was a very pretty girl when I first knew her. And when she always talked about Buddhic consciousness. And I said to her, why do you use that word Buddhic? Why don't you just say Buddhist? It's an ordinary word in the dictionary. And Buddhic sounds spooky. But she went on talking about Buddhic things. And eventually, dressed in pure white, and had all things in her room white, and crystal balls on her table, so that, you know, there was nothing earthy left about her. She was much too pure. Anyway, to realize cosmic consciousness, to realize that this universe, that what there is all of a piece, doesn't mean that it's like this lady's room all white or without any differentiations in it. And sure, it's full of differentiations. Look at it. But actually, these differentiations are all the dancing of a single energy. And you are that energy. And the thing that you don't realize in the ordinary way is that all energy goes on and off. It's pulsing things. So now you see it, now you don't. Now you're alive and now you're dead. You see? And we, because of our limited vision, don't see. That doesn't matter in the least. The conceit of thinking that when you're dead, that'll be the end of everything, you know, is just appalling. Naturally, you'll come back, but you won't remember how it was when you were here before, for the simple reason that if you did, it would be a bore. You know, just like you feel you're here now without remembering ever being here before, you can feel you're here again without ever remembering you were there before, which is a definition, simply a definition of what we mean by somebody else. You know, after you're dead, you'll be somebody else who thinks he's you. Because that's what he says he is. He says, I am I. That's your name. Just don't worry about it. The only thing is there is some sense in looking toward the future, so that when you come back again, the world will be a reasonably decent place to appear in. Only, as a matter of fact, you simultaneously appear in all worlds. In whatever planets there may be, with other people on them, each one of them, as it comes into the world, is you. That's because that's how you feel. They all feel like that. From the point of view of astrophysics, in a curved space-time continuum, every point in this universe can be regarded as its center. It's like, you look, what is the central point on the surface of a sphere? Well, any point can be the center. So in the same way, the fact that you feel that you are the center of the world is exactly the truth. You can see equidistantly around you in all ways, you see. And you feel as when you are out on a ship on the ocean, and that the horizon seems to be a circle. Well, that's just because you're in the middle. But everybody's in the middle. Wherever you are, you're in the middle. That's why St. Bonaventure referred to God as that circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. So modern man, in the West in particular, after he abandoned the Ptolemaic theory of the world and took on the Copernican, and then realized that the solar system was only on the edge of a galaxy, has felt awfully put down. You see, it's a terrible shock to find out that. Because, you see, he felt again, you see, as if he wasn't in the center and wasn't really, didn't really belong. And that's why, that having become our common sense, we have such hatred of nature and have been fighting against it so hard. But the more you study astronomy, the more you realize that that isn't, that's only a partial look at things. I know a psychiatrist who uses astronomy for psychotherapy. He himself has an office where he practices, but no home. He lives on Mount Tamalpais in a tent. And every night he enjoys the view. People perhaps don't realize that you don't have to have a beautiful home like this to have a good view. All you have to do is lie on your back. And you're looking straight out into the most incredible view. Goes on and on forever. And to begin to realize, you see, that you're on a spaceship. It's a big spaceship, beautifully equipped. And you're going on a long, long journey because it's not just the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. The Sun's moving and carrying you along. And at a pretty good clip, quite fast enough for anyone. And the beautiful thing about this existence is that, in a certain sense, everything moves by falling. But there's nowhere for it to hit. I mean, unless something should collide in the course. But we're all in a completely relativistic space. And there's no up, there's no down. There's no right direction, no wrong direction. We're behaving on this, in this galaxy, like a whole bunch of gulls. You know, when the wind blows, the gulls like to get up high. And they rock around in the wind, and they plunge, and they dance, you see. And this whole cosmos is going, blah, you know, swinging around, having a ball. Well, it's all a lot of balls. Naturally, it has a ball. So, but it needs an extension, it needs an enlargement. A universalization of our consciousness in order to be able to feel it that way and know that that's what it is. And so, therefore, to do that, there must be some way of overcoming myopia, of overcoming, shall I call it, fascinated identification with only a single part of the process. And so meditation, jhana, yoga, is the art of this defascination, and that is why it is called liberation from maya, from illusion, from being spellbound, enchanted, bewitched, befuddled, and bewildered. The Buddha means the one who is awake. The wake, as in the man who was called Hereward the Wake in early English history. So Gotama the Wake would be an excellent translation of Gotama Buddha. Wake up. So meditation then is a process of clarifying your consciousness. Rather, as one allows a pool to be clarified. When it's clear, you can see what's on the bottom of it, and you can see the sky reflected in it. You see both the heights and the depths in a clear pool. But in order for a pool to become clear, either cleared of mud or cleared of waves, there's only one way to do it, which is to leave it alone. If you try to smooth the waves with your hand or with a flat iron, you'll just stir up more trouble. If you try to push the mud down, you'll just make it all the worse. So you have to leave it alone. It's very difficult, however, to leave your mind alone without going to sleep. But doing that is the whole art of meditation.